This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling. JT Allen, this is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 14 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, of course, as always, joined by the chap they call Alan as we take a trip around that outer rim of WCW Nostalgia Mothership. Alan, how are you, sir?
I am great as always, JT. Hello, listeners. Another great episode lined up here. We've got some good questions on the show. Well, just before we start the show, we may as well just let people know if they want to send questions in, they can do that. They can send them in to either of us on Twitter at Alan_Cheapshot, that's A-double-L-A-N, or they can send them in to yourself at place2bnation. The other way you can send questions in is via email, which is probably the best method, which is letters@gmail.com. Also, you can send questions in if you comment on the actual shows that we post on place2bnation.com. There's a discuss kind of thread underneath each kind of post where you can, you know, ask your questions there as well. They're really the best places, aren't they, JT?
Yeah, the comments section, we're a couple weeks in on that, and it's been going pretty well, so we're excited there. So be sure to drop in and share some comments on the show too. And yeah, also some big news, Scotty Riggs has reemerged on social media, Alan, and we're in touch. So it looks like we're maybe finally making that interview happen soon, so we'll have more on that as we move along.
Yeah, he's been blackmailing me. He's been trying to get me to make him GIFs of some of his matches because he gets a kick out of it. And unfortunately, there's not that much Scotty Riggs kind of footage on YouTube from like ECW from when he was Scott Anton. Right. That's kind of stuff he wants. It's, you know, it's all on the network. So I've hooked him up with some GIFs.
And for some reason, he's obsessed with using Dan McGinn as his agent online. So we're not sure why. But anyway, he keeps wanting to put him in the mix. But good for you, because Dan's something to do, I guess. So, Alan, why do you say it's time? I think, to maybe jump inside the plunder bucket.
Let's do this.
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
So, dear Alan and JT, I thought Harley Race was a good manager, especially with Big Van Vader. Why did his run in WCW as a manager end? Who else did he manage during his managerial run? And that's from Tortured Soul Version 1 via email. So thank you very much for the question there. So Harley Race is a manager. He was around WCW from 1990 to 1995 in a kind of manager capacity. I know he wrestled some in 1990, didn't he, JT? He worked the Great American Bash versus Tommy Rich.
Yes. Yeah, because he was in WWF as, you know, pretty active for a while, and then he got hurt, and then he comes back a little bit into early 89 and then leaves after he loses to Haku in the Battle of the Crown, and then reemerges in mid 90. I mean, he still could go. He still looked pretty good out there, and even that match at the Bash isn't bad. Still spot monkeying around, so he's there. And then, yes, he does take some time off when he gets hurt at the end of the year, and then boom, we're right into his managerial career.
Yeah, so his managerial career was around about 3.5-4 years, so to speak, up to the end, into 95, and we'll talk about why he left WCW in a moment. But the wrestlers that he managed, a lot of people think it's just kind of Big Van Vader, but he managed quite a few people during his WCW run, didn't he? So I'm just going to go through some of the names now. So most famous one being Big Van Vader, but before that he managed world champion Lex Luger at the tail end of 91 into 92. There was Tyler Mayne. He wasn't called Tyler Mayne in WCW. That's the guy, was he in
Saber
the X-Men films?
Yeah,
he worked, I think he was in WCW's Big Sky.
Yes.
I think his gimmick was. He was a really tall dude that I thought would have done WCW would have done more with, but he was really just on the syndicated shows. He tagged a lot with Kevin Nash, didn't he, as Vinny Vegas, who was also, funnily enough, a guy that was managed by Harley Race. But those two tagged quite a lot on TV, but he never really came to much, apart from then, obviously, years later, he got a good movie career out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was definitely Sabretooth in X-Men, and you're right, he was Big Sky. I think he was from... It was funny because he was like one of the only wrestlers I remember being from, like, was it like South Dakota or North Dakota or something? It was like a weird spot that they said he was from. It's one you never hear.
So, yeah, we had him. We had Vinny Vegas, like I said. We had Yoshi Kwan, who was someone that was feuding with Cactus Jack in 1993, a faux Japanese kind of threat into WCW. We had Super Invader, who was Hercules, wasn't he? Super, yeah. Yep. Was Super Invader. Who had the mask, didn't he? It was something awful to work in. He had one of those full... It became more popular in the 2000s, you know, those full body suits.
Right. Yeah, it did not look comfortable at all. Yeah, it was the full tights and then the full-on mask. And, you know, for a guy that struggles at times, like Hercules does, probably doesn't need anything impairing his vision in the ring.
No. Another team that he managed was the Colossal Kongs. That was brief. But they were abysmal, weren't they? They were around in like 1993. They were just two huge, you know, masses of guys. I mean, they weren't that tall, huge. They were like 500 pounds apiece. They were, you know, just big men. But they didn't really, you know, stay long in WCW. I thought they sucked, so I'm glad they didn't stick around long. And finally, he managed Mr. Hughes, also in WCW. So there's a fair array of different wrestlers there. So looking at those guys... JT, who would you say is, you know, the main charges? I'd have to say Vader and Luger, really.
Oh, for sure. And the other guys, if you look at it, were all pretty much usually just brought in under Race as part of something going on with Vader or Luger, right? Because, like, Mr. Hughes, wasn't he Luger's bodyguard? So he manages Hughes because of that. He manages Yoshi Kwan because he's a mercenary to take out Cactus Jack before Vader does. And then the Colossal Kongs were brought in because Flair and Vader were kind of few. You know, so like all these guys that come in and are managed by Race usually are because they're tied into one of his main guys. Like they're not just kind of running on their own. I guess maybe Tyler Mayne and the Vegas team was kind of on its own. But everyone else seems to be pretty tied into something else he had going on.
Yeah, so Race himself, it was the managerial part of his career. He basically said the managerial part of wrestling was something I never really cared for at all. So I think he just was one of those guys. He'd been, you know, a legend in the business. He's been wrestling since the 1960s. And I think once your kind of run is over, you still want the limelight a bit. And it's understandable, really. It's something that you would miss. So I could understand why he would do this. And I bet he was given a good money offer as well, to be fair, to, you know, be around Luger, be around Vader. And, the, you know, the guys that Race can talk to, Race can, you know, give him knowledge, you know, backstage when they're on the road driving from town to town, if he was, you know, with them at the time. And I know he was with Vader anyway. So it definitely would have helped. Vader has said it helped his career. Vader's gone and said, I felt honored to be with him, was one comment. And nine out of 10 times he come up with something better than me. Well, that's understandable, really, that he would say that, because you can see that Harley Race had a great mind for the business. Like I said, he'd been around for years and years and years. So I think Vader admitting that is quite a cool thing. And the other thing that Vader said was he'd never criticise me in front of anyone. He'd do it driving 100 miles an hour with me privately on the road. So that Harley Race got a bit of a reputation for being a guy that would drive from town to town very, very quickly, something that I don't think he could get away with today. Do you guys in America have speed cameras on your highways that if you go past the camera at a certain speed, it will take a photo, and obviously then you have to pay a fine or get, you know, get in trouble?
Yeah, they're becoming more and more prevalent. Like, there's definitely red light cameras, so if you run a red light, they'll have like speed warning digital signs. There's not too many though, like monitored speed cameras, at least around here. I mean, maybe in some bigger cities there are. Still rely pretty much on police on the side of the road, but there's definitely more and more cameras at like busy intersections in downtown areas that will track if you're running red lights or running, you know, in some areas toll booths or whatever.
Yeah, so I don't think he would get away with it as much as he did in the past. So Harley Race himself, though, what did you think of him as a manager, JT? Did you think he was, you know, he had a credibility? That's kind of main thing I felt with him being around. So have you got any kind of takeaways from his run?
Yeah, no, I liked him as a manager because he could take bumps if he needed to, but he had that credibility. He had the name value. It meant something if he was running your career, because to me it always felt like, all right, this guy, he doesn't have to be doing this, and he is because he sees something in this talent, right? So like he's only picking the elite and then guys to surround the elite that can help protect them. Like he's just – his main two guys ever were Lex Luger, world champion, and Vader, world champion. Like, and that's it. You know, he's nothing else. Everyone else is just kind of fodder for him. They're foot soldiers, you know, from a Ninja Turtles perspective. So he's just piecing everyone around as studs. And I did think he was definitely believable. I thought he cut, you know, great promos. He was a really good talker. But he was also a guy that a Vader needed to talk. Like, he could kind of be in the background just kind of looking menacing. So it was, I thought it was a great pairing. I thought him and Vader is one of the more iconic solo, just kind of manager wrestler pairing or acts that we've had, especially on the WCW side. Like, when you think of Vader during this run, it's hard to picture him without picturing Harley Race standing next to him in that kind of red, you know, velvet or whatever, velour. No, not velour. What's that? Like satin, I guess, satin jacket he'd wear. So,
polyester to me. Look, it's something straight from Jim Cornette's wardrobe.
Well, he'd wear that sometimes, but he'd also kind of wear like the satin, like red coat with like the, you know, kind of like a spring jacket you'd wear. Like, I don't know.
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, you like kind of like a gym, like a gym jacket you'd get as like a novelty act or something. Anyway, something like that. But anyway, he would, you know, you could picture that look in the two of them standing there together. And I mean, if you check out the playlist too, there's some really good promos by him and some very, very antagonistic and questionable promos by him as well. I guess we could talk about in a few minutes.
Yeah, he's someone that I really enjoyed as well at the time. I was very surprised, though, because by 1993, WCW was getting very, very wacky, which we touched on, you know, we talked about, not touched on in the last episode with the mini-movies. So him to be involved in trying to kill or maim or whatever he was trying to do and blow up the boat of Sting and Davey Boy Smith was quite interesting, because it was totally something that if you said to Harley Race in the 70s, this is what you're going to be doing on national TV in 20 years' time, it'd probably slap the, you know, the taste right out of your mouth. So I was very shocked, you know, knowing, you know, his history,
right,
even, you know, in 93 that he would be doing things like this, but obviously he didn't give a shit and he went along with it. But people didn't know there's a few occasions in early 1991 that WCW attempted to actually fire him for cost-cutting reasons, which I found quite interesting that wasn't talked about. So they brought him in, and I think straight away they realized this guy's costing a lot.
Right.
But as he was managing Lex Luger at the time, it was Luger who stood up to management and forced their hand to keep him on the payroll. So that's good of Lex to do that, to keep old Harley around. I think obviously a guy that he would have respected massively. But, you know, guys like Jim Herd wouldn't have done so. They'd just seen, you know, numbers, you know, on a piece of paper and said, this guy's costing us far too much. He's not generating as much money. Let's get rid of him. But he did make guys as well, make them look good. You know, some of the faces, he took some awesome bumps for the likes of Rick Steiner and Cactus Jack. You know, he's always good for, you know, taking a bump from the apron into the ring was a good one. But you could throw him around. You could throw him off the top rope onto people. He was still happy to do stuff at this stage of his career, which was, I thought was really good. Because there's a lot of managers that, you know, people like Gary Hart, you can't touch him at all. He doesn't really, you know, add much to the match. You know, people say Gary Hart was his fantastic manager. For me, he was a guy that rubbed Great Muta's belly fantastically, you know, in 89 in WCW. But, you know, all over, he was a guy that you couldn't really get one over on him as a face. You couldn't, you know, give him, you know, what he deserved, so you couldn't get your heat back off him. So he wasn't really someone I was a huge fan of. But someone like Harley Race was, you know, he was great. He would give his body for anyone, which I think is a good trait for a heel manager.
And he was and he was believable, too, when he doled out the offense. You know, like, you get, like, a Jimmy Hart over, like, scratching and clawing. But, like, Harley, if he pops you in the face with one outside the ring or whatever, you know, you believe that it hurts. You believe he's menacing. He has such a track record of just being a brute and a nasty heel that when he's out there being vicious, it's completely believable. It doesn't seem, you know, like, I've always brought up, like, a Mr. Fuji at times where he seems like he's just out to lunch out there. And the way, like, he was built up through, like, commentary and shit. Like, oh, the devious one plotting. And, like, he's just standing out there, like, staring into space with this vapid look on his face. And you wonder, like, how he's really imparting any knowledge into his wrestlers. But, like, Harley, you can actually see drawing up a game plan and setting Vader on course to beat the shit out of some guy. Like, go out there and murder Sting. And, you know, it's almost like he's living vicariously through Vader. Like, here's another this beastly guy, the evolution of Harley, you know, this big guy that can bounce around and beat the piss out of people, surly and nasty. Harley can't do it full time anymore, so he goes out and gets Vader, and he runs vicariously through Vader. Like, that's how I always looked at it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, as we have talked about over the past few weeks, the big one coming up, it's Super Brawl. Inside a 15-foot-high steel cage, the Thunder Cage, this man, Vader, is going to be meeting the WCW Heavyweight Champion, Ric Flair, for that coveted title in a cage, Harley Race.
Flair, you barely survived the last time. Now you're in a cage that we constructed, that we were there and helped weld together. So you're not getting away, Flair. Talk to the big man about it. Flair!
What did you make of some of the interviews he gave then on the playlist, JT?
He's definitely old school, because there's the couple with the one with Ron Simmons is not good.
We got the 7-time world heavyweight champion here, Mr. Harley Race, along with the Super Invader.
Jesse, let me tell you this. I heard Sting out here a few minutes ago. I heard him running his mouth about Harley Race and Big Van Vader. Let me tell you, just a minute. Ron Simmons, you're a friend of the champion, Mr. Sting. So do me a favor and be an errand boy and run me back a message for Sting.
Well, let me tell you something. You got your year wrong, and you got my name wrong. This is the year almost 2000. This ain't the 18th century, and my name ain't Gopher. And if you won't sing, you go get him yourself.
Let me tell you something, Mr. Simmons. 7 different times I was world heavyweight champion, and I had a like you carrying my bag.
Well, that was too insulting. What a distasteful remark.
I mean, he calls him a boy, he calls him an errand boy, and he says, back in my day, we had, it gets beeped out, but I'm guessing it's either the N-word or the C-word, and tells him that we had guys like you carrying our bags. I mean, it's really, really rough, and then Simmons attacks him, but not great there by Harley. But I liked him, you know, he was a good talker, like we saw it in the mini-movies last episode, where he was out there, and we said, remember, he kind of stole the show in some of those, but even in the one he has a confrontation with Davey Boy Smith, he's really good, and he's just, you know, makes clear, coherent points, and he sounds like a badass. Like, he's just a really good, strong promo.
Yeah, it's his voice as well, his gravelly voice. It's right. Really something that, you know, you stand up and pay attention to because he's quite unique. But yeah, he was definitely someone, like I said, that I enjoyed in WCW. And I think from what you said as well, JT, you were happy with his run during this time period. But the reason he actually left in 1995 was he broke his hip. And I think that was in a car accident. So obviously with a broken hip, I know from my uncle who broke his hip a few months ago that the recovery time's quite long indeed. It's six mm-hmm. months to a year till you're fully on your feet. So 6 months, a year after this, we're moving into the Nitro era. You know, WCW are on the road every week. They're not doing TV tapings. I don't think Harley, at that stage of his life, after breaking his hip, would really want to go back to that WCW. So I can understand that, you know, was him basically over on TV for a national promotion. He really wouldn't do anything else at all thinking about it. He wouldn't show up anywhere, would he? I think obviously conventions and things, but he was never on TV again anywhere from memory.
No, I mean, I think just like Legends things and stuff like that. I don't remember him really, you know, ever showing up or doing anything substantial. And it's, you know, it's kind of sad because, I mean, I don't know. Maybe
I know where he showed up. He showed up in 97, I think, in WWF at the Bad Blood pay-per-view because they did a tribute to St. Louis. They had some much in it there, and obviously Harley Race being
Is he there by that point? I feel like he doesn't show up in WWE until, like, later.
It's a cameo. No, it's just a cameo on a one show. They bring a load of guys in.
No, I know. I didn't think it was him for some reason.
I could be wrong, but I just think the ties there with Muchnick and St. Louis, and obviously had a part in the promotion, a stake in there at one stage as well as Kansas City. So yeah, I think, you know, he was he came and, you know, did some fleeting appearances on TV for the WWF, you know, later on. But that was him done in WCW. So that was pretty much answering the question there about Harley Race. So
do you think it was fitting time wise for him to go? Like, we've talked about before how 94 is kind of the transition era. Like, it almost fit that he didn't hang around into 95, into the Hogan goofiness, into the NWO. Like, he kind of was there for that gritty, old-school WCW era and then kind of left at the right time.
Yeah, I think that's fair, to be honest, that 95, the business was changing. Harley Race would have been exposed more and more because, like you said, he was still making comments that you could not get away with. He was just, right. You know, and you're not going to tell a guy like that to change his ways. His ways. I don't agree with him. Well, that's the way he is. So I think it was probably better in the long run that he wasn't on TV for much longer than he was anyway.
Yeah, I would agree.
So we'll move on to the second question on the show, JT. So let me just delve into the plunder bucket and grab this one out. So, dear Alan and JT, who was Lee Marshall? I know he used to voice. I know you use his voice on for the 1-800 Road Report, and that's from Jody Simon in Florida on email. So thank you very much for the question there, Jody. So Lee Marshall, we do use him on the show when we do the 1-800 Road Report when I get in my car, which I'll be doing after this question, mm-hmm. funnily enough, JT. Well, who was he? He was someone that has been around for quite a long time. I mean, he's passed away now, unfortunately. Did he pass away the other year? I think it was, you know, last year or the year before he passed away, which unfortunately, because he's still quite a young guy. I think he was only in his 60s.
Yeah.
So that was a shame that he's no longer with us. But yeah, Lee Marshall, someone that was in the AWA. He was part of the broadcast team when the AWA Championship Wrestling Show was on ESPN. And before that, he was actually part of WrestleMania 2. Some people may not realize that. He was the ring announcer for the Los Angeles portion of the show. So I don't think he's referenced at all by the commentary team or anything, obviously, because he's just a guy in a suit, you know, doing the announcing. But that's pretty cool that he was around back then. So yeah, then into the AWA and then into WCW. So WCW wise, JT, mm-hmm. he's not really always there, is he? He kind of is there for a bit, then you don't see him, and then he's there and he does the road report. He doesn't really have a fixed kind of role in the promotion.
Yeah, I would say his main role was the road reports, but he's also the women's expert, if you remember. They bring him in quite often for the women's matches. So it's when they started bringing in Tanay as the cruiserweight specialist, and then they would bring in him as the women's specialist. So I think, you know, like 95-ish, he gets a decent amount of run in as the third man in the booth.
You're right.
To call the women's matches. And I feel like he worked. Wasn't there a Cindy show? He definitely worked like pretty regularly. Was it, I don't know if it was pro or worldwide. I feel like there was one where he was like the main guy. And then it was the Nitro Party / 800 Collect were his big thing. I mean, he may be one of the few guys that was on almost every episode of Nitro for a couple years there. I mean, you hear him every episode. It's regular, the 1-800 Collect Road Reports. Like, that's on every episode. And he always got his weasel joke in. Of course, he's famous for that, the corny weasel jokes. And I feel like that was kind of a nod. I mean, I don't know if they were in AWA at the same time, but I like to think it's an AWA thing that they go back as friends. I mean, I think that's pretty much his, you know, call to fame. So I guess he did host Thunder for a bit too, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did call. Yeah, just looking through that, I forgot about that. He was co-hosting Thunderside, Heenan and Schiavone, and he would do some interview stuff with Mike Tenay and Scott Hudson on WCW Saturday night as well. Right. But the other thing, he was always at these Nitro parties. So do you believe that Lee Marshall was at a Nitro party in Macon, Georgia, or he's just backstage, you know, pretending that he knew some college kids?
Oh, yeah, definitely backstage. I mean, I like to, you know, if you let your imagination run wild a little bit, you can picture him, like, driving through Jacksonville. Oh, I gotta hurry up and get to this Nitro party at the University of Jacksonville. Like, imagine fucking Lee Marshall pulling up on campus to the security guard, this, you know, 40-year-old man pulls up, and they're like, oh, where you going, sir? Oh, I'm here to visit some kids for a Nitro party. Like, you think they'd let him on campus, or are they smuggling him into the party? Like, Lee Marshall shows up in your dorm, you know, whatever, party room to watch Nitro with, you know, eat pizza and stuff. Like, so it's, I mean, I don't think it was real, but I like to imagine that he really was going across the country. But I always did feel bad for him, if it was true, that he was never in the spot that Nitro was happening. So he's constantly missing out on the action because he's always a week ahead of where the big party is. And that's when Nitro is actually occurring in that city. You know, he's always a week ahead of these towns. So he's out on the road on his own. I picture it kind of being a lonely existence. And he's trying to hit these parties up just to have some kind of life, some social life, because he's by himself all the time out on the road in all of these different cities.
Yeah, poor Stagger Lee Marshall, because that was his nickname, wasn't it?
Stagger Lee. Here we go, Stagger Lee.
But he always, I liked that he'd always call Heenan about three or four times when he called in, doing the road reports, calling him, sneaking in the weasel comments.
Yes.
You know, calling him weasel, 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 which I always digged as well. But he was one of the announcers at the 1996 World War III pay-per-view, doing the three-ring battle royal, and he covered the third ring with Larry Zbysko. So that was his role on that pay-per-view. So it was used, you know, here, there, and everywhere. But his entire run was, he did three events as a commentator on WCW pay-per-views. Mm-hmm. He did seven events as an interviewer on WCW pay-per-views.
God, that's it? I feel like he did so much more.
Fan support really means a lot to a lot of these professional wrestlers. For example, I think of competitors like Eddie Guerrero or Rey Mysterio Jr. Anywhere they go, they attract a huge amount of Latino fans. Likewise, it doesn't matter where we go. If there's a Canadian in town, they're going to show up when either Chris Jericho or the amazing French Canadian show up. And then there's Ming, who hails from the island of Tonga. Let me bring him on in here. Wherever you go, it seems that a lot of the Tonganese, the Samoan people, the island people, they come from wherever they've got to come from just to watch you compete. That must make you feel pretty good.
What are you trying to say? You're trying to say, Mr. Major, that we are rowing the canoe all the way here?
Well, no, I was just making a suggestion that you have a great deal of fan support.
That's why we're so big like this, because we rowed the canoe all the way from the island. And let me tell you something, everywhere we go, there's always a lot of Tongans there. Samoan, you talk about the Fijian, Tahitian, you name the whole South Pacific, the Hawaiians, they all are law and law there.
What? They do what?
You didn't get that?
No, I didn't get the last part. But that's okay. As a matter of fact, this is a great opportunity for you to speak directly to the people of the islands about what it's like competing in the WCW.
Well, it's a great honor to compete in WCW. But the most of all is being with the Dungeon of Doom.
Ah, yes.
We always ready to any kind of action. Call us and we'll be there to take over on WCW, NWO, Four Horsemen, whoever you want to put in front of us, we're going to take care of them.
Why is it that people refer to you as the monster?
The monster?
Yeah, they say the monster's turned loose.
Turned loose?
Yeah.
Because they haven't seen a real wrestler step into that ring, but this man here. So is the Dungeon of Doom. When we talk about wrestling, we're getting there and to destroy it.
I think I understand why they call him the monster. Well, Tonganese or not, Samoan or not, when this man's in town, buy a ticket. See the Dungeon of Doom. You're not going to be sorry. You'll see action.
Wow.
Yeah, his first one was 96 Uncensored. His last one was 98 World War III. AWA, as we said, he was did one event as a commentator on a pay-per-view in 88, which was Super Clash. And he was with Ray Stevens of Vern Gagne. And he did as well the Woman of Wrestling show, which was with Bobby Heenan. And was in, I think, 2001. And I'd never watched that show. I don't even have a clue who was on this show, but I can imagine it had a pitiful buy rate and, you know, it wasn't great. I bet you it's one of those shows that's on YouTube. I might even put it on the playlist. I don't know, but it's one of those shows that I can imagine is full and on YouTube. There's no copyright claims against it because no one cares anymore.
Yeah, he, well, he was the woman's expert, so... you know, that's why they brought him in.
Why was he? Why was
I don't think it's real. I mean, I think they were just trying to give him a role, is my guess, because they had Tanay as the specialist there. I mean, but AWA did have a pretty, like, decent depth-wise women's division, so maybe he was tied in to that at the time, and he knew a lot about women's wrestling. I don't know. I just always assumed that they were just making it up to give him a role because Tanay was brought in as the expert for the Lucha guys or whatever and the Cruiserweights, and they brought him in just to be the specialist for that. So I think they were trying to, like, show that they had depth on the roster of announcers to say, okay, we have specialists in this area and a specialist in this area. And I'm guessing that Marshall obviously is a buddy of Eric Bischoff from the AWA, brought in, you know, just to bring him in and give him a job because they were close in AWA or something like that. And so he just kept him around and gave him something to do. That'd be my guess. But Alan, as you may know, of course, or maybe some people out there don't know, he actually was maybe more famous for some role that he had beyond wrestling.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, he was great, of course. He was the voice of the famous Tony the Tiger in all the commercials. They were great. That was Lee Marshall doing all those... all those ads, which is pretty awesome. That's a cool.
Well, he was
connection.
The second one. He was the second yes. Tony the Tiger. I think the original one would have been up until I don't know the history of Tony the Tiger and Kellogg's, but I think Lee Marshall got the gig. Was it in the 2000s? I don't know. Did the guy die? I'm not too sure, but he had the gig, you know, for a good 10, 15 years until he passed away, and he's now in the big Nitro party in the sky.
So
unfortunately,
Lee Marshall did it. Okay, he was actually the third. So the first one was Dallas McKinnon. Did it for a year. And then the infamous Thurl Ravenscroft, who, of course, did the Grinch song. He was 1953 to 2004. So, yeah, I mean, he did it forever. And then
That's a hell of a run.
That's a great run. A great run. Lee Marshall was 1999 until 2014. So he had a really good run, too. And then Tex Brasher is the current voice of Tony the Tiger, apparently. Still going today. And then, yeah, Marshall passed away in 2014 at age 64. So he was doing the voice right up until his death, it seemed.
They're great.
oh, well, that's Lee Marshall. He's a nice footnote in the wacky world of WCW. Perfect for this show, JT. So I'm glad we've covered him and been able to discuss him. So thanks for the question there, Jody. So
I always pictured him, too. I'm sorry to interrupt. But I always, for some reason, the Man Called Sting song, I always pictured him singing it. And I don't know why. I picture him in a studio by himself snapping his fingers singing the song. That's just the picture in my head of when I hear that song.
Well, that's the lasting image you're going to leave with Lee Marshall. Well, funnily enough, it's not, because we're going to go to him in a moment. He's going to help me with the 1-800 road report. So shall I do what I do every week, JT? Shall I grab my keys, get into my car, and hit the road?
That's a great idea. Yes, you should definitely head in your car. Let's head over to Alan, the chap called Alan, for this week's 1-800 Collector Road Report. Looking at this week in history.
Hello there, Staggerly.
Hey, what's happening, Tony? Actually, I got a Nitro party that's on the move. We started in Atlantic Beach. I'm now in Neptune Beach, and I promised to make a quick stop at a Nitro party at the University of North Florida, so hold on, guys. Hey, did you guys hear what happened here yesterday in Florida?
No, what was that?
It was Round Weasel Day. Yeah, Punxsutawney Bobby stuck his head out of his condo, saw a shadow, so we're going to have 6 more weeks of bad taste. That's your 1-800-COLLECT road report from Jacksonville. I'm Lee Marshall for 1-800-COLLECT.
Well, it's July the 24th, and I'm in the convention center in Cleveland, Ohio. Ugh. And this week, we have got Lance Storm defeating Big Vito in a title versus title match to win the WCW Hardcore Championship. And this was Storm's US title was on the line against the Big Vito's Hardcore title. So this was when Lance Storm was, you know, running roughshod over WCW, and he was picking up title after title. So how many titles did Lance Storm actually have at one point in WCW, JT? Can you remember?
Boy, I think, didn't he have everything except the world?
So that would have been the title, and the Hardcore title.
Yeah.
So do you think, 3 titles, I think, at the time, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't remember if he had the tag. I was going to look, but he definitely, the U.S. he had, and then the Hardcore he had, he called the Saskatchewan Hardcore Invitational title, the shit title. And I believe he had the TV title might have been retired at that point. Let me see. Oh, he had the Cruiserweight title. He had 3. He had the Hardcore, the Cruiserweight, and the U.S. Those are the 3 he had.
How did he have the Cruiserweight title?
Yeah.
Well, obviously it was the weight that they needed at the time. Right. But yeah, I think it was highly pushed at this point. This would have been 1999, July 24th. So it was getting a fair, was it 99 or 2000? I should really know this. I should be prepared for our own shows, JT. I didn't write the actual year on, but it was a fairly big deal in WCW TV at the time.
Oh,
it was pushed quite heavily. It was the whole Canada feud that they were doing. Obviously, they witnessed the success of it in WWF a few years earlier, and they plugged into that. And he was a fairly entertaining heel around this point. This was his biggest run, I would say, overall. Obviously, into WWF he was featured, or into WWF, WWE he was featured, you know, quite often as well. But I think not as much as here. I think, would it be fair to say this was his peak in his career?
Absolutely. I mean, he came in and he was a marquee guy for them in 2000. He was a guy that was all over TV, dominated the mid-card. You could tell. I mean, I think he's one of the guys that is probably on the short list of guys that really benefited from the Russo era. Like he got a huge push under Russo and was positioned as a top guy, to the point where when he came into WWF and the Invasion, I mean, he felt like one of the top guys that they gained. You know, it was like him, DDP, and Mike Awesome, kind of like the big three coming in at that point, and then Booker. So, yeah, I think he, and even in WWF in the early, early days, he was positioned pretty well, too. I would say he was used well until, like, the end of the year. I mean, because he comes in, he wins the IC title, fights Edge at SummerSlam, teams with Hurricane. Like, that was pretty big. And then I would say by 2002, he's pretty much just a guy. So I would say his peak is 2000 through 2001 in both promotions. But I don't think anyone used him better than he was used during that summer of 2000. Because remember, too, he has the match where he brings in Jacques Rougeau as the special referee, and then because they had teased it that he was going to have a Canadian legend as the referee against I guess Mike Awesome, and because the show was in Vancouver, so he brings in, everyone thought it was going to be Brett, and it ends up being Jacques Rougeau, and then Brett shows up after the match and hugs them both, and the three of them celebrate. So it was kind of a unique moment. But he has the big feud with Duggan then joins Team Canada. If you remember, he renounces the U.S.
Yeah, shaves his beard off. He didn't have a beard at that point, did he, as well, Duggan? It looks a bit weird.
All right, it's like when Scott Griscola shaves his face. It's just off-putting. and then he was feuding with General Rection. Like, that was his big feud, you know, formerly Hugh Morris. So, I mean, that's kind of what he had going on. But the Team Canada was pretty cool. I like the team overall. Like, Elix Skipper, I was always a big fan of him at that time. And he also, my boy Pierre, Carlo Ouellette, was part of Team Canada as well. So I was a big fan of that run. I'm a mark for anything Canadian like that. And I like that stable. Just all three guys were really cool. And then, so anyway, I liked what they had going on.
What do you think of Lance Storm now then, in the modern era? I mean, he's virtually retired, but he's doing some good things with the Storm Wrestling Academy up in Calgary. He's churning out a lot of talent there. They're going on to NXT, but as him as a personality, he's got some salient points sometimes, but he just rubs me up the wrong way other times. I don't know. He's someone I'm very on the fence with as someone. I do respect him. He's knowledgeable. And I did see him work the other year. I went out to a show and he was actually the draw for me. That's why I went out to the show, because I wanted to see him work. Because he is fairly good in ring. He's just punches are awful. Always been his downfall. Really, really weak puncher. But he's someone that doesn't take criticism well, I don't think. Quite thin-skinned. And he doesn't do podcasts now on Wrestling Observer. He used to do one with Brian Alvarez. He does his own podcast now, doesn't he, with the Jackal.
Cyrus.
Cyrus, yeah.
Yeah.
He's doing the new Japan gig. But yeah, I'm not a huge fan of him. Now, can you give or take him, or are you not bothered?
Yeah, he's all right. I mean, I'll say this. He's credible. Like, yes, the thin skin stuff, and like maybe he's a little outspoken at times, but I will say, like, a lot of what he says always comes off as credible to me. Like, he doesn't come off like he's just running his mouth or making shit up. Like, he seems like a guy to me that doesn't really have much to gain by making stuff up. He just kind of is who he is. So, to me, I take his opinion as legitimate. I don't think he's just making shit up. But I do think, I agree with you on the, he could be a little thin-skinned or... But you know what? He is, one of the best adapters to this era. He was an early adapter to social media and stuff like this. Remember he's doing like a Storm book club for a while, and like he's very open to talking to fans. And I feel like he was one of the first guys that really embraced this current modern times of ways to interact with the fans. And he's kept with it. I always enjoyed his return at One Night Stand when he fought Chris Jericho and they did that stuff with the Impact players. Like, I thought that was kind of cool. I'd say I'm more of a fan than I am not a fan of Lance Storm overall as his whole career and even today. I mean, I don't make a point to like listen to him or read his stuff, but when I come across it, it doesn't, like, I don't just dismiss it. I'll put it that way.
Oh, that's fair enough. Yeah, I mean, he's got a voice and he's got some salient points, but there's something that he just rubs me up slightly the wrong way. I don't know, but there we go. That's Lance Storm beating Big Vito on July the 24th. So shall we now go on to the long question, JT?
That's what I love.
Right, well, hopefully there'll be a little bit of a debate between us here, so this will be a good one. So, Dear Alan and JT, ranking things is always fun. So how about ranking of each year from 1989 to 2001 based on quality of matches, angles, TV shows, supercards, etc.? So we're going to break this question down into two parts. We're going to do the next part on the next show, hopefully. Okay. So we're going to cover 89 to 95 here, and we're going to give them a grade for each year. I haven't got to ask the question, but it was someone on the discussed section of the website, wasn't it? You can make the comments on Place to Be Nation underneath the posts.
Yeah, you sent I'll it find over out to who me. Was.
Yep. Yeah, we'll start telling them in a minute. Thanks for the question anyway. So let's get straight to it with 1989. So for me, 89 was maybe my favorite every year. Top to bottom in WCW, anyway, WCW, but they've been bought by Turner at this point, so it's all intents and purposes WCW. And I think the first 6 months of the year, absolutely legendary, fantastic TV matches. You've got the whole Flair versus Steamboat feud. A lot's going on around this time. We're getting, Sting's coming, more and more into, being a threat for the title in 89. Obviously, he had the, 88, it was his breakout year. He'd come from the UWF. He had the match with Ric Flair at Clash 1. But 89, he really cemented himself as one of the top-tier stars in WCW. The Flair-Funk feud was amazing as well, how that happened. The whole run with Muta with a TV title. It's fantastic. So I gave this one an A- for the year. I think the problem for me was the whole stuff at the tail end of the year. It was the Halloween Havoc finish of the match that they had, Flair Funk, and was it Thunderdome Cage match? Wasn't great. But in 1989, the tag division was ultra strong as well. And we finished the year off with Starrcade 89, which people don't really like as a show, but I was a big fan of that show. The kind of round-robin format of the singles and the tag team wrestlers vying for who would be the wrestler of the 90s. So what kind of your overall thoughts of 89, JT?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to debate. I mean, this Flair Funk and Flair Steamboat, those feuds alone, are, you know, give it an A, whatever, in the A range. I mean, how many companies have had, you know, at least between WCW and WWF, how many years have we had two feuds like that? And yeah, it's a very sport feeling in 89. It's, you know, yeah. I don't think I have much more to add than what you said. Starcade is interesting. I don't mind the round robin, but I don't know. It reminds me a little bit of like Battle Bowl, like we've talked about in the past, where Starcade to me always felt like the biggest show of the year. It should be the blow off and culmination of major feuds and title stuff. And like this felt more like a concept show. I guess I don't really get why they always use Starcade as concept shows. Like they had all these other pay per views and all these other months and shows they could use. Why are you making your grand, you know, your marquee show, your final show of the year, always like either a Battle Bowl or the World Cup with New Japan or this round robin? Like I don't get what their hankering was to make Starcade always like that. For whatever
okay,
reason,
well,
that
I've got yeah. a theory. You know, Starcade was a Dusty Rhodes invention, right. really, wasn't it? Where was Dusty Rhodes in 89?
Not there.
WWF. Yep. Not there. So, you know, up to 89, 83 to 88, you know, it was matches, and right. then the world title match to end. So 89 was the first change, and that coincided where Dusty wasn't right. in WCW anymore. So I think that there may be something there, you know, with that. And then when he came back in, he'd given up and didn't care as much about Starcade. So, right. you know, he just went along with the flow. That's why we saw back. Yeah, well, he might have been Balbo, baby. You know, he may have been, you know, his idea anyway. But yeah, he was. You could tell that maybe it would have been a reason. But yeah, maybe the reason I liked Starcade 89 was it was one of my first Turner Home videos. I think I would have got this in about 91. So I thought it was a cool show. I watched it, you know, so many times growing up as a kid. So it might be that's the reason I enjoyed that show. But moving on to 1990, we had the whole Dudes with Attitude kind of stable. This was Sting and JYD. And who else was in the Dudes with Attitude? There's definitely Sting. Yeah. There's definitely JYD. But they were kind of foil against the Horsemen. And, you know, there was... That was fairly interesting for you throughout the year. But then what we had was Sting, you know, getting
injured. Was it Giante? Was he part of that thing?
Yeah, he probably was as well. It was a lot of faces, wasn't it? They just combined together to face the Horsemen. But yeah, then we had the Sting injury, the knee injury in 1990, which should have been catastrophic, but, you know, it didn't end up being that way. They managed to hold on all right. Ole Anderson was booking around this time, and he booked himself into a corner a few times in 1990, but overall, they had the talent there. They had some awesome tag matches in 1990. Mm-hmm. The Midnight Express, you know, all over the show. Just, you know, they were getting jobbed, you know, out in 1990, courtesy of Jim Herd. But, you know, there was a lot of good matches. It was them versus the Southern Boys. I think that was a really good match.
Yes.
So I think 1990 was a fun year. And I would probably give this year a B ranking. So what have you got any memories at all of 1990 that kind of stand out for you, JT? Apart from, you know, the Black Scorpion.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely what stands out. No, I think you, again, covered most of them. Havoc 90, I like a lot. Of course, that great Steiner's nasty slugfest. It's got the Doom versus Flair and Arn match, which is really good. So I know that's always one of my favorite shows that year with the Philly crowd and everything. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think 90 is a lot of good stuff, not great stuff. I think that sums up 90. And the Black Scorpion definitely drags it down, especially when it just ends up being fucking Flair again. It turns him heel because of it. And then we're kind of right back where we were to start the year. But yeah, I think B is fair.
Yeah, B. So we're going to 91 now, and this is a hodgepodge of a year if I've ever seen one, JT. And to me, this is the first time WCW looked like itself and not looked like a Jim Crockett promotion. There was more of the lighting had changed, the presentation had changed on TV. Still, there was mistakes here, there, and everywhere, and it did look low rent compared to the WWF, you know, in this era as well. But definitely a shift from what we used to in the past. But yeah, I think 91 is going to be a standout year because we all know what happened. We've touched on this on previous shows: is Ric Flair leaving to join WWF, and I think that's the overall kind of story of 91, JT. And it was not until the end of the year that they really kind of picked up again. They had Steamboat, you know, coming in. We had him and Rhodes as tag champs. We had the formation of the Dangerous Alliance. We had Rick Rude coming in at Halloween mm-hmm. Havoc 91. So it was more the middle of the year. And, you know, we spoke about it on the last show. It was the Great American Bash in 91, and that was a bad show. And I think that was where they hit rock bottom. And then the only way was up. But luckily, by the end of the year, they'd recovered.
Yeah, I think it's a tale of 2 years. I'd probably, yeah, maybe like a C+, just because it's, to me, it's like there's a lot of good in the back end. the first half is kind of just all over the place. You know, you got Flair's thing with Fujinami, which was like fine, but it's hard to kind of get into, you know, it's like it's cut out of nowhere. I would say, to me, this is very just middle of the road. And you're right. Like the fulcrum of the whole year is the Bash 91, just a terrible show. And it is definitely the first year that doesn't feel like Crockett anymore. There's a lot of change. You get a lot of the kind of cornier, cheesier gimmick starts to seep in. You can tell they're trying to be WWF light instead of being an alternative at this point. But they do kind of pivot again at the end of the year with the Dangerous Alliance forming. Paulie Dangerously gaining more on-screen time and power was a good thing. Rude coming in was really well done in Halloween Havoc. And we have the Chamber of Horrors, of course, right? Was that 91?
We
get that enjoyment. Like Vader's kind of coming into his own, too, in 91 a little bit. So, yeah, I like the back end of 91. Not a big fan of the first 6 months or so. So to me, it's C+ is like a very middle of the road. There's some really good. There's some really bad.
Yeah, it's still wacky in the end of 91 because we had Battle Bowl and we had the Chamber of Horrors match, like you said, with Abdullah the Butcher getting fried by Cactus Jack, sat in a kind of electric chair in the middle of a cage in the middle of a ring. So, yeah, it was quite far removed from a straight wrestling match there. But into 1992, and this is when the Dangerous Line heats up. They weren't really the horsemen of the 80s, but they were, to me, probably the best stable of the 90s. I think that's a fair thing to say, really, JT.
Oh,
and
for sure.
They are a major reason why 92 was... It was a good year TV-wise. There's some really good matches into 92, and this is where we had the Hollywood Blondes coming in at the end of the year. And I think, you know, that was a fun time as well. Mm-hmm. Hollywood Blondes going into 93, everyone talks about them. You know, the run wasn't long enough, but 92 we had the War Games match, the War Games
awesome.
Show, which was a great, you know, just awesome. We had... Beach Blast 92, which again was a great show. We had the tag tournaments in 92, which were on TV. We were bringing guys in at this point. I know in 91 they had Liger, but we had like Hase and Hashimoto they were bringing in 92. We had the Miracle Violence Connection, Gordy and Williams coming in. So
and Super Bowl 2 was a really good card too. I mean, that's a strong show too. The end of Luger, of course, where Sting beats him for the title, which is a pretty good match.
Yeah, and I don't think we really noticed Luger leaving. I think, you know, they did well to kind of plug that gap with the Dangerous Alliance because Luger in 92 dropped the title and then he, you know, went to the WBF because he had a no-compete clause. Right. And then obviously into 93, he went into wrestling for the WWF themselves as a narcissist. But I think they did well really by, as I said, you know, covering over the, you know, gaps of losing, you know, your major heel because they built Dangerous Alliance well in, you know, the back end of 91. So they kind of had the bases covered. So this was a rare example of WCW. I don't know if they planned it, but at least they had someone in the background that could take that position.
Yeah, no, I agree. They definitely were positioned that way. And Luger, again, almost like we talked about Harley Race earlier, kind of felt like time for him to go. Like I felt like he had kind of maxed out in WCW at that point. He obviously is barely even wrestling. He just shows back up at Super Bowl to drop the title. I think it was time for him to go. And they had a good cachet of guys that could step up and fill in for him, kind of in the war chest on the heel side, especially with Vader really emerging. Like, it was good to get Luger out of the way so Vader could ascend to being the top heel. And I should, you know, I mentioned earlier that 1991, the first half kind of stings, but, you know, you brought up War Games, of course. The 91 War Games is awesome, too. So that's you know, a part of the first half of 91. But War Games 92 was tremendous. I am a well-documented huge fan of the Dangerous Alliance and that whole storyline. I love the end with that War Games. It's so awesome. And you also have the Rick Rude, Ricky Steamboat feud, which is great. They have a bunch of really good matches in there. You know, the end of the year sags a little bit with Jake coming in and the Halloween Havoc. We talked about it last week. The coal miner's glove match kind of sucks. But on the flip side, you got Vader out there just destroying guys throughout the back end of the year. And him and Sting had great matches. They have the great one at the Bash. They have the King of Cable. The one, you know, like they fought a few times in these great, great matches. And their feud was epic during a time where business was in the shitter. But from a quality standpoint, I think 92... 92 is one of my favorite years. I mean, you do get a little bit of the boring stuff, courtesy of Watts, like, you know, really pushing Gordy and Williams down everyone's throats. You know, whatever. Depends what kind of a style you're a fan of, I guess. But some of that stuff can be really tough to sit through. 30-minute match with the Steiners comes to mind. But I liked the tag tournament was a cool idea. They were trying different stuff to really... 91 was a year where they were trying to be WWF light, and you could tell Watts 180'd that and really tried to make it unique again. And it felt that way. Like, this is when I really got into WCW as a kid, and it felt completely different than what WWF was putting on. And it was more athletic for sure. When you look at guys like Sting and Vader and Rude and Steamboat and Austin and, you know, Pillman and all these guys, Liger. Don't forget that was going on too with Super Bowl, Pillman and Liger. So I may go A minus on IDC. Like, I think there's so much good stuff, and we're not even talking about, like you briefly mentioned, the TV is unbelievable during this time. There's like hidden 3.5-4-star matches every week on Saturday Night or Worldwide with the Dangerous Alliance and six mans and tags and eight mans. There's so much good stuff going on week to week on TV. They also had, you know, I think this is what JR and Jesse are kind of the main team throughout 92. I'm more of a fan of Shivani and Jesse, but I think JR and Jesse are good too. Jesse's still motivated, still super into the product. I think that helps 92 a lot as well. So, and I like the Watts booking. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of 92. And I think pay-per-view and TV were all strong, except for a blip toward the end. I'd probably go A-minus on 92.
Well, you love that year then. So the standouts from 92 quickly is the Bill Watts era, like you touched on, is the removal of the mats and the top rope, which was a negative, seen as a negative. Looking back, for me, getting rid of the mats is only going to hurt the wrestlers. We're there to protect them, not to really make the working environment, you know, less safe. So I don't think maybe that, you know, that was required in that era. And the top rope thing was a dumb idea. So I'm glad they kind of changed that and brought the top rope back in 93 or later 92. So into 1993, it's a bit of a mixed year again, JT93. Mm-hmm. We saw kind of Regal, one of my favourites, who debuted in early 93. So that was a positive for the year. We had the tag team title match. Slam B was awesome. We had the Blondes also. Versus Steamboat and Douglas was a fun feud.
Yep.
The Vader Cactus Jack kind of angle, you know, was, you know, really interesting around this time. Yeah. Oh, God. You weren't seeing stuff like this in WWF in this era. Nah. So that was quite serious stuff and was, you know, really brutal. And Vader had a fantastic match with Dustin Rhodes at one of the clashes, which I really digged as well.
Mm-hmm.
We also had Paul Orndorff came, you know. No, he was not. Was he a dude with attitude going back to 1990?
He was. He was around a while in WCW, but 93 is kind of where they reboot him as a heel. And then they end up forming Pretty Wonderful in 94.
Yeah, so there was that as well. Was the match with Cactus Jack where they were hitting over each other over the head. I think it was Super Brawl with spades and things.
Yep.
I think we had Steiners left the promotion in 93, so they went into WWF, so we lost
the
them.
Yeah.
But we still had, you know, the Blonde, Steamboat, and Douglas, and the tail end of 93 where it got a little bit rubbish with some of the guys that they had. Like I said, the Colossal Kongs, Awesome Kongs, whatever they were called, and, you know, teams like that that weren't too great. But 93 was a mixed bag for me overall. I would go with a C minus for 93.
See, I feel like that's... I think 93 is really underrated. You're right, though. The back end kind of slogs a bit. The first half is still... You still get some of the Watts goodness in there. And Davey Boy Smith has an underrated run in 93. Like, he has really good matches with Vader in there. The stuff with him and Sting. And also Super Bowl is good, too. You get Sting-Vader rematch. The Benoit Tuchel Scorpio match is on there as well. You know, obviously the Hollywood Blondes, do, like you said, the feud with Steamboat Douglas kind of, you know, lingering on. Things turned a bit to me. You know, Flair comes back and then he's doing the Flair for the Gold, which had some fun bits. Obviously the Face Horseman stuff was kind of blah with Roma and Arn. You know, so that kind of lags a bit, and the Nasties come in and they're, you know, whatever. They don't really get inspired until 94. Tony and Jesse are really good throughout 93. I love them as the main commentary team. Battle Bowl is that show we talked about a few weeks ago that is just a trudge to get through, that Battle Bowl 93. That is a long show. But all the Flair and Vader stuff was really good. I really enjoyed that. You know, you get
Sick. The end of the year. I didn't like the match. I thought it was a major disappointment for a show was Fall Brawl 93. We had Rude versus Flair.
Kind of a boring match, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a major disappointment for me because I was watching WCW a hell of a lot in 93. That was probably one of my peak years in terms of watching it. It was on TV every week over here. We got Worldwide, so I was following it that way, and I was getting the magazines and things by this point and videos. So I was well into WCW, but I was kind of still wishing it was as good as 92 and 1990 and 89, which it was never going to be, you know, as strong as that again in my eye. But, 93... So where would you go with it? What would you rank it? I give it a C minus.
Yeah, maybe a C plus. I guess the back end is kind of shaky, but I think there's more good stuff. Like 93 to me is a year when people hear it always think, oh, that's like whatever, the bottom of the barrel, WCW, like bottoming them out, you know. But I think there's actually more good stuff in 93 than is remembered, and again, I like, you can see like the fingerprints of Bischoff starting to come in too, where they bring the tapings to Disney, and they start to stabilize a little bit of that stuff. And, you know, you get Austin versus Dustin toward the end of the year too, which is pretty good. And I like the Cactus Vader, but there's also a lot of goofiness. Like, they were trying different stuff in there that's kind of goofy, like Lost in Cleveland and all that shit. So, and you're right. Fall Brawl was disappointing, and the War Games was not that good that year. That's the one with the Shockmaster and all that shit, with Sid and Vader and Harlem Heat.
Oh, yeah, we had Flair for the Gold in 93 as well.
Yeah, which was good. I mean, obviously the Flair for the Old with Austin and Pillman is pretty legendary. So, yeah, I would say, and even Pillman and Austin's feud isn't bad. So, yeah, I would probably say C+, B- in there somewhere. And Shivani and Jesse, very underrated team.
So we're moving into 94. This is going to split us here, JT, I think.
This may end letters from center stage right now, this discussion.
First off of the year, as we've touched on before in previous shows, really, really good. The Flair Steamboat stuff. We had the marquee of Queensbury Rules matches with Flair and Regal. Flair's kind of face run. Everything else in 94, we had the Cactus Sullivan Nasty Boys, Sullivan versus Nasty Boys, Cactus and Max Payne versus Nasty Boys kind of feuds, which were all interesting. They were quite brutal matches that they had. I think Spring Stampede in 94 was a fantastic pay-per-view overall, from memory. But then what happens in 1994 is Hogan and his buddies come in. And that really kind of ruins it for me, sours it for me. As a fan at the time, didn't like it. Obviously, from a business perspective, and it was a good move, a wise move for them. But I'm looking at this morely as a fan, just for enjoyment, and it kind of soured me on the promotion. They were WWF Lite, they had Hacksaw, they were bringing Honky Tonk Man, they had the Butcher. I mean, you're having the Butcher versus Hogan headlining Starrcade in 1994. We had Earthquake was around as John, the Avalanche. He was feuding with Sting. It really wasn't interesting.
But a lot of that is into 95. Go ahead. I'll save it.
Oh yeah. This is the reason why I'm going to give the year a D, all right? And that reason is the retirement match at Halloween Havoc 94, between Flair and Hogan.
Yep.
And then the whole thing around it, and then not very planned well, and he's coming back by the end of the year anyway into 95. That's not how you handle Ric Flair. That's not what you do, for me. And I think that really was a stupid booking decision for WCW. I know they wanted the big buy rate for Halloween Havoc, but...
Well, I think they wanted Flair out of the way, too, to give Hogan some time to get his feet under him.
Yeah, I can understand that. But, Flair was still the face of WCW. He was what, for a lot of people, was, the symbol for WCW, the Southern fans. And then to kind of move him out the way, have Hogan just coming in, retire him, have a feud and then retire him after 4 or 5 months, I just think wasn't the way to go. I know that's to keep Hogan strong, but just not a fan of it. So, yeah, this is the major reason why I'm giving this year a DJT.
That's like Will condemning any match that includes Don Morocco as shit is the worst feud or match of anyone's career. Just because of that one thing, given this year a D. There's so much good stuff in this year, and I reference it always, but me, Will, Charles, and Scott actually went through the entire year of 94 WCW. It's across two podcasts a few years ago. It's on Place to Be Nation or at placetobe.podbean.com. I think you can find it there. And it was a real fun time. We watched every pay-per-view and every clash. And the first half, I would put up Super Brawl, Spring Stampede, and Slamboree as... one of the greatest three consecutive pay-per-view stretches of all time between WCW and WWF. It is a tremendous three-show run. Super Brawl is probably the one that lags, the most of the three, but there's still some really good stuff in here as well. The Thunder Cage match is a lot of fun. Flair Vader in the Thunder Cage is really good. It has that awesome 30-minute Regal versus Arn TV title match, which is, this is hidden gem in the middle of this card. And then you get the Spring Stampede, which is arguably maybe WCW's best ever pay-per-view, top to bottom. Flair Steamboat, 32-minute title match, Sting versus Rude, Buck versus Dustin Rhodes in the bunkhouse match, Vader versus Boss, which is just great. They beat the shit out of each other. Nasty Boys and Cactus Jack and Max Payne, that's the Wild Chicago Street Fight. DDP and Bad. And, there's just so much good stuff on that show. And then Slamboree as well is really, really good. So you get that. I mean, three all-time pay-per-views, back-to-back-to-back. One of the things that did hurt this part of the year was, subbing Jesse L for Bobby Heenan, I thought was actually a downgrade. I was never a big fan of WCW Bobby, but if there's ever a time where he's okay, it's in 94 before he just kind of gives up. But he just brings that shtick in that just feels so dated. Jesse was such a better fit for WCW, I thought. He was so much more realistic, and that's what they're trying to present. And then Hogan comes in, and... initially it's okay. Like, Bash of the Beach is still a really good show, and you kind of get the vestiges of the old WCW. you know, Flair goes heel, obviously. But then you get Halloween Havoc. Again, is a pretty good show. And that match in the cage is actually good. Like, both Hogan-Flair matches are pretty good. Then things get wonky. From the end of Halloween Havoc through the end, through Starrcade is a mess. And Starrcade is not good. As far as Hogan's cronies go, Duggan, I actually would argue, was pretty good in 94 WCW. It's not till later that he falls apart. The only reason he is hated so much, and I hated him for years because of it, is that he squashes Steve Austin at Fall Brawl out of nowhere in his debut, and that sucked. But he has a great match with Vader at Starrcade that's often overlooked. So 94 to me is one of my favorite years in WCW. I think there's so much good stuff in there, and you don't get the full Hogan hokiness until like November, and then it bleeds heavily into 95. And Flair, his ridiculousness doesn't come until 95 either. He loses the match at Havoc, but he doesn't get like absurd until 95. So like, I don't count that for 94 because he just loses and kind of vanishes. And I thought Vader was in his final days of being a badass, because that feud with the Boss and Sting goes all the way through 94. Like, they fight like five or six times, and they have a really good triangle match at Fall Brawl. Like, those guys beat the crap out of each other. Yeah, I like 94 a lot. I make no regrets about it. Or no.
I think I'll give you my really bad analogy here. Say it's a school year. You work really hard in class all the way through the year, and then the final exams come at the end of the year, and you flunk them massively. You really, really mess up. So all that hard work you did earlier on in the year, it completely goes out the window. You make a complete tit of yourself.
That's a terrible analogy.
Well,
because you're still not
going.
Yeah. It's still because you still have like 10 months of really good stuff. And Starrcade is not a final exam. It's just they're 2 months of 12. So you're still getting 10 great months. It's like, it's better to say you have a test each month and you aced 10 of them and failed two. You would take that.
Yeah, but the two that you failed were the big ones that will get you, take you from high school to college. And unfortunately, they flunked.
So 95 is college, then they went to the worst school in the country. Then
that's the reason why.
I give 94 a B plus.
I agree with your points at the start. It was the first, you know, 6 months of the year, 5 months of the year, it's an A. You know, it really is. I don't disagree with you at all with any of that. And some of the stuff that goes into the second half is good. But it's just Hogan coming in and changing everything and Flair retiring. And I just, no, not for me. So we have to agree to disagree, I think, on this one, JT.
I agree you're wrong, sir.
Right, so we're going to 95 WCW, the college years. So there's not really, you know, much redeeming in 95, no. Bar the tail end, the whole Nitro thing. It does pick up there, and the pay-per-views at the end of 95, bringing in some interesting guys like Sabu was coming in, Jerry Lynn was coming in, TV was interesting, Luger turned up. But, you know, the start of 95, my God, Hogan versus the Dungeon of Doom. The Dungeon of Doom never, ever felt like a threat whatsoever, did the JT?
Oh,
I think
God,
it was
no.
Just complete mess. We've talked about this on the show where we talked about the cage match that they had at Uncensored, but that Uncensored show in general.
Hang on. By the way, 1994, one last throw that I just remembered, I forgot to mention, Fall Brawl. The awesome fucking Dustin Rhodes reunion on The Clash where they embrace.
Oh my God,
so good. And then the War Games is awesome too, where they go to the bar and get the nasties and they fight
Stud Stable. Yeah.
Oh, and that whole year, Stud Stable versus the Rhodes is so good. You're crazy, man. I'm going to A-minus for 94. That stuff is so awesome. That's like the last.
That stuff is awesome. I love that promo. It's one of my favorite promos of all time. I posted the full thing on Twitter the other week, the video clip of it, and a lot of people remember it and love it still. So,
that,
you know, I agree with it. It's just that thing at the end.
That War Games to me is the last great old school WCW Crockett style match.
Yeah, no, that's like, fair. But into 95, I think we should agree on 95 then, JT.
It's dog shit.
Happened to Vader? What happened to Vader in 95?
He just gets so ruined. You know, he has the feud with Hogan, which starts well because he confronts Hogan at the end of Starrcade, and that's like really cool. And he looks like menacing. And then they have the match at Super Brawl where Hogan wins by DQ. And then they have the one at Uncensored that has the flare and the drag. And now Vader's just kind of made to look like a goof. And then they keep feuding. They have the tag stuff with the mega powers. You know, Savage comes in and they're doing the tag shit where they end up beating Flair and Vader. And then we get all the Bash of the Beach where Hogan finally beats him. Yeah, all the Baywatch stuff where Hogan beats him clean. Flair Savage 95 is pretty good. I like the 96 stuff better with Liz. But 95 is not bad too. That's where I think Flair beats up Angelo Poffo at Slamboree and all that stuff, which is pretty fun. But overall,
we had Max Muscle. We had people like Max Muscle
on
TV every week.
It's a bad year. This is where you can really see the Hogan influence throughout the card up and down. And the Dungeon of Doom, it was atrocious. I mean, you got Kamala, you got fucking Zodiac, Shark. I mean, none of these guys are believable. And it leads to one of the worst War Games of all time. I mean, it's Hogan, Sting, Luger, And who was the fourth guy? It was supposed to be Vader, but Luger steps in for Vader.
Because Savage gets fired.
Yeah, I mean, that is a ridiculously stacked team. And you're going against freaking Kamala, Brutus Beefcake, you know, Shark, and Sullivan. I mean, that is just like an atrocious match right there. I mean, there's no believability at all. And Starrcade, 95 to me is like the inverse of 94. 94 to me had like 10 months of great and 2 months of shit. Whereas 95 has 10 months of shit and 2 months of where they're figuring it out. Like, I thought World War III was actually pretty good. They end up doing the Dark Hogan stuff. And then Starrcade, they start the New Japan relationship. You got Nitro going where you're getting more high-quality TV stuff on Nitro. You're starting to build Sting and Luger's friendship in the end of 95, which is good stuff. So it's very similar to WWF, actually. They kind of have similar years where, like, late 94 to late 95 in both promotions is, like, just an awful 12-month stretch. And they both kind of figure it out at the end of 95.
Yeah, the other things from 95 just to touch on was Hogan burning the Observer on the Clash of the Champions, if you remember that.
Yes, yep, that's part of the dark, evil Hogan.
Yeah, well, that was fun looking back at that. And also, what you touched on was Vader being ruined. So the reason that Hogan beat Vader at Uncensored was he dragged... It was a strap match, wasn't it? So he didn't even drag Vader around the ring to win, you know, touch turnbuckle, because he dragged Flair around the ring in drag.
Yeah,
Flair
it was awful.
It's just not good at all. It was cringeworthy. It's one of those shows. Imagine you're watching wrestling and you say to your friends, "Oh, I love pro wrestling and ECW. This promotion is looking good." And then this, that, and the other. And then they walk in on you watching this. You know, this entire show is just embarrassing. It's just you know something that should be buried and no one should see again because it's that bad, and it just ruins guys, you know, reputation a little bit. And I thought, you know, it sucked. And then you had that match where Dustin Rhodes got fired. He was the cage. So he was run.
It was in the car. It was the flatbed truck that they wrestled in the bunkhouse match there.
Yeah, and then the guys bled and they were told not to bleed, and then they let go of Dustin Rhodes, and you know he was still, you know, fantastic talent, and then obviously he made his career being gold dust, you know, after that, which you never thought that would happen at the time, but yeah, right. He managed to pull that one off at the end. So yeah, 95 at the end, like you said, the whole World Cup thing was fun. They bring the New Japan guys in, Flair wins the title at the end, bloodied and, you know, battered and bruised. I thought that was fantastic. We had the Sheik throwing a fireball at Halloween Havoc in 95, which I thought was, you know, really interesting to do. But yeah, the first 10 months of the year was just awful. So I'm going in with a D for this year as well, JT.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that one.
Right, so that's the first half. So we've gone through that. So would we say then for you, your favorite 2 years would be 94 and 89?
Yeah, 92 as well. Those are my top three.
And then you, the worst year out of this, would you say 95?
Oh, that's another question.
By landslide, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well, going 95 being the worst year in overall, but 94 to me, just for those booking decisions, just stands out like, ugh, wasn't a fan of it. So, yeah, well, that covers that section. So we're going to go next episode, 96 through to 2001. So it's going to be good the first few years of this, but then, you know, we're going to be giving low grades, I can imagine, by the end of it.
And at the end, what we'll do is we'll rank all the years. We'll throw a ranking out for how we'd stack them all up.
Yeah. So thank you very much for the question. It was Bettis who sent the question in on PlaceToBeNation.com. So thank you very much for that.
Big fan of the show, too. He listens like day of and shares thoughts. So thank you, Bettis.
Yeah, thank you very much for being a fan and supporting the show. But anyone else who listens to the show, anyone you think would love the show, tell them. Tell a friend, tell anyone that used to love WCW. Rate and rank us on iTunes as well, because like I said previously, that does really, really help the feed in general. So it's not just the show. Check out other shows on the network, such as your another show you did, JT, drop this week, didn't it? The one with you do with your pal Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff Learns Wrestling. That's on the PlayStation Wrestling feed on iTunes. And Jeff was on vacation, so it had been a few weeks between episodes, but he came back strong. We looked at some stuff from WrestleMania 2 and the big event in the summer of 86. And the next episode is going to start taking us into the build to WrestleMania 3. So he's ready to go. He's jacked up, still on course. It's a great show. Kevin Kelly approved on Twitter, so make sure you check it out. Yeah, each and every few weeks, I guess. And the Place to Be podcast, of course, myself and Scott Griscolo, often joined by Kelly Nelson, too, each and every Monday. Check out all the Pod Blasts as well. Lots going on for the Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project. Details on that at PlaceToBeNation.com. We have the comment section now open. We have discussion threads daily. Check it out. Shop with us, PlayStation.com/Amazon, and spend your time with us on social media as well.
Yeah, awesome. So thank you very much for listening, guys, and we'll be back again next week for another Letters from Center Stage.
Each and every Friday. For Alan, I'm JT. We're out. Talk to you soon.
Adios.
Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo!
At the Mauler, completely maul his opponent, Steve Dahl.
What I've heard.
What just said, the softball game?
My magazine called it the Harvard of professional wrestling.
They're great.
Always go swimming with a buddy. Work real hard and always study.
All right, the Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's a guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot!
You red-headed booger, you!
This is Fred.
Yes.
Now, if you can't find your scissors...